This is the Wisdom Podcast.
Welcome to the Wisdom Podcast. My name is Daniel Aiken, and today we meet Jerry Stribling, a former Marine and author of Buddhism for Dudes. In this episode, Jerry talks about how he developed a friendship with some Buddhist monks while working for a non-profit that protected elephants in Sri Lanka. This time had a profound influence on Jerry, and he found that the Buddhist teachings were incredibly helpful for his work with veterans and addicts. So please enjoy this conversation with Jerry. I'd start by asking, how does a dude, someone who's been in the military, get into Buddhism? How did that come about?
If we go back to Kosovo.
Kosovo, wow. Yeah.
My expertise at the time was how to habilitate people with severe mental illness and developmental disabilities. Mm-hmm. And when the Kosovars repatriated their country, they left many of their mentally retarded, mentally ill people back in Montenegro, and I should have gone. Mm-hmm. I know that business real well. I could have done a lot of good, but I didn't, and mm-hmm. I felt bad about it. Mm-hmm. 9/11 comes along,
yeah,
and all my friends are quaking in their boots. This school teacher came bawling to me one afternoon, saying that she's so afraid of flying now she'd never get to see Ireland in summer again. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to show you people there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, it's fear. Mm-hmm. So my original destination had been Pakistan. We went in 2002. Yes. In the winter, and there were going to be a lot of Afghani children who were displaced during our initial invasion. Yeah. So I was going to go and help set up schools on the Afghani-Pakistani frontier. Well, it got real, real too dangerous to do that. Yeah. So I figured there are other nasty little wars in Asia that I could, you know, maybe be a help. And I ended up in Sri Lanka. Mm-hmm. It was pretty fortuitous. I had no intention of studying Buddhism. I was curious about it, yeah. But I had the opportunity to, and if you want to talk about karma, you can, but yeah. I studied with three of the most eminent Buddhist theologians in the country.
So September 11 happens, and your impulse is to go and help.
Go and help.
And to go and help in Pakistan.
Yeah.
My goodness. And what were you planning? What did you see yourself doing in Pakistan?
We initially just setting up opportunities for kids to continue their educations, mm-hmm. During their displacement before they could go back because of the American invasion.
Yeah.
So that was kind of vaguely my idea.
Your idea. But of course, you were probably told that that's not a good idea by the administration or whoever you were talking to organize such a trip.
The Daniel Pearl beheading was kind of the end of that.
Yeah.
Adventure for me. They don't cut your heads off in Sri Lanka.
Yeah. Yeah. So you wanted to keep your head, and
yeah,
you thought Pakistan was not, but then Sri Lanka became the destination, and mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how Sri Lanka came up for you.
Oh, I have a friend who was in the military, American military. He was an officer. Now he's been living in Tokyo for 25 years. He's a spy. Lance, you're a spy. I'm outing you.
You're going to out him out now.
I out him every chance I get. But, I'm fishing around for something to do in Asia.
Yes.
And we're corresponding, and he says, well, why don't you consider Sri Lanka? And I says, no, Sri Lanka is just as dangerous as Pakistan, isn't it? And he says, Arthur C. Clarke has been living there for decades. Mm-hmm. And he says it's the best kept secret in Asia.
Oh, wow.
And I just fell in love with the country.
So you headed over there. And what type of work were you doing in Sri Lanka?
I was originally engaged by an organization called the Millennium Elephant Foundation. Uh-huh. Excuse me. They're part of the World Wildlife Fund. Mm-hmm. And they provide elephant veterinary services all over the island. Mm-hmm. But it also is a place for older elephants, working elephants, to go and retire. Uh-huh. So I lived with 9 European girls and 6 elephants.
Wow. You got to know elephants.
Got to know elephants. They're fascinating.
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating.
And so did you enjoy that there, or was it work, or what? It was just a beautiful place
to be. It was so fun. The Asian children are just the most incredibly easy kids to get along with. I still got a bunch of them, Burmese refugees, that I see at my temple in Louisville. Yeah. I see them every Sunday. They're different. They're cooperative. They're always in a good mood. You never see one cry. Mm. I had in Nepal. They come to my house every Halloween, trick or treat in my neighborhood. Uh-huh. And one of the little Nepali girls slipped down the stairs and scraped her leg up pretty bad. And we brought her in, first aid, not one whimper.
Yeah.
Not a single whimper. Uh-huh. One tough little girl. Yeah. I admire toughness. I think that Buddhism is a way to become tough. I think that the end game from meditation, you're exercising your brain, you're strengthening your brain continually, and I think of it, among other things, as a way to prepare yourself for death and to handle it. Mm-hmm.
So you were like mixing with the local community in Sri Lanka, and then you came across Buddhist monks, or did you come across a temple? How did you? Mm-hmm. Because at that time you hadn't studied Buddhism yet, right?
No.
And you hadn't really.
I had a vague interest in it.
Vague interest in it.
I had a baseball cap with Buddha on the front of it.
It's as close as you're on Buddhist team, but you, but you were yet to study. So then, how did you come in contact? Was it monks? Was it did you go to a temple? How did that happen?
I like to do solo stuff. Uh-huh. I looked at a website called idealist.org, and there were several opportunities in Sri Lanka. The Millennium Elephant Foundation was interested in me because it's a rural setting, and what I did was set up 3 little English language learning centers that operated on the weekends for the little village kids in 3 different villages. The Samara Singh family operates the Millennium Elephant Foundation, and they have this grand dame mom called, whose name is Karmini Samara Singh. She was really my first guru. Mm. She and I first started talking about Buddhism, and she lent me a book or two.
What book do you remember?
It's that one written by the 2 women about Vipassana meditation.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about? Yeah.
So it's like meditation instructions in that book, or just general Buddhist concepts?
It tried to explain, the first half of it explained the mechanisms of Vipassana. And then the second half was sort of exercises.
Great.
And things. But she wanted me to meet this monk named Pimaratana. He at the time, he looks like Yoda. He looks like Yoda.
Yeah.
Excellent English speaker. And he was, at the time, he was professor of Buddhist studies at the University of Anuradhapura. Mm-hmm. And we just spent afternoons together on the veranda when it was too hot to do anything else but talk.
Wow.
And I learned a lot from him. He was more of kind of an anecdotal guy. And he really liked to stick it in your ribs every now and then.
Which is your style, right?
I remember. Coming from a military background. Yeah. I remember I was there with a young woman from England one time. And Pimaratana says, England, that's a more Buddhist country than Sri Lanka. And the girl goes, what are you talking about? And he says, you take care of your elderly.
Yeah. Yep.
From there, I developed a curriculum. And the curriculum kind of got around, and somebody from the UN saw it.
What do you mean you developed a curriculum for?
I actually developed a conversational English as a second language.
Oh, okay.
Curriculum that I stole most of it from a Spanish language thing, but then I adapted it to that culture.
So you were teaching English?
Uh-huh, once I got the centers started. And now young women, mostly from Europe, when they get out of university, will pay $2,000 and go live at the Millennium Elephant Foundation for 3 months and teach in my little centers.
Oh, nice.
So, and the revenue, you know, it looks good on the girls' resumes.
Yes.
And the revenue basically goes to support elderly elephants.
Mm-hmm.
So that one turned out pretty good.
That's nice. Nice thing to do. So you've always had this, you know, impulse to help, right? Help the community.
It's been a really strong undercurrent in my life for a long time. Andy says it's evidence that I lived a past life. But even when I was a kid, when I was 15 years old, I was a Red Cross volunteer in a hospital full of wounded Vietnam vets.
Yeah. So it's very interesting because a lot of people study Buddhism and then find that they want to help the community. But for you, it was a little different. It was you had this impulse to help community and then you found Buddhism and then it was, well, how can these tools help me help people? Is that sort of your journey a little bit?
When I studied Dharma, it was not so much of me learning something new as it was a confirmation of what I already knew and believed. When I was in the Marines, in basic training, I taught a guy how to read.
Yes. So you've always been teaching and helping.
Teaching and helping.
Wow.
And almost exclusively.
And so in your book, Buddhism for Dudes, you say... Terrorism had a hand in creating this book. And so that, you're talking about 9/11,
right?
You wanting to go and help, ending up in Sri Lanka, meeting these Buddhist teachers.
Exactly.
And what was it about these Buddhist teachers, what was it about them that spoke to you? Because here's a guy who's been in the military, you know, tough guy that wants to help, but tough guy nevertheless. What was it about these gentle Buddhist teachers, or were they not so gentle?
the senses of humor that I picked up. The second summer, I lived in a Buddhist monastery, and it was a training facility for young bhikkhus, and nobody was ever in a bad mood. Everybody was yucking it up all the time, starting with Pema Ratana. He would come out with some real zingers.
Yes.
Sometimes when I was trying to figure out what the second noble truth was all about, he says, I started the conversation with attachment is bad, right? Well, I've been married to the same woman for decades. I have two kids and I'm so attached to them. I just couldn't imagine wanting to reduce that level of intimacy for the sake of being an objective Buddhist. And Pema Ratana says, no, that's not it at all. You are living the Buddhist householder ideal.
Yes.
And then he said, you call yourself a compassionate man. At the time, I was teaching in an Orthodox Jewish elementary school. he said, you call yourself a compassionate man. This was also after 10 years of doing social work on behalf of people with developmental disabilities. He says, you can measure how compassionate you can be by the amount of compassion you feel toward your wife, because you will never love anybody more than her.
And this is coming from a monk,
He prefaced it by saying, well, I don't know a lot about these sorts of things. But that really, really came home to me. after I finished in Sri Lanka and came home, I got a job. I was hired to it's one of these, oh God, we got the grant now. What do we do? Let's call Jerry Easterbling.
Yeah.
And it was a program to help reintegrate military veterans who were coming out of prison. Mm-hmm. And so what I learned in Sri Lanka, I was able to implement in the Incarcerated Veterans Transitional Program. Mm-hmm. And I told my staff, who were all veterans, mm-hmm. this is the way it's going to work. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to be friends with these people. Mm-hmm. We were in the military. They were in the military. There's great common ground there. So it's not a case manager and a client. It's two veterans solving problems. Mm-hmm. And the program was enormously successful. We had a 15% recidivism rate in 3 years, and that's as low as you can get. Mm-hmm. It would have been a lot lower had it not been for cocaine addiction. Mm-hmm. That's what sent most of the guys who went back tested positive for cocaine when they went in for a parole. Otherwise, out of 250 guys, there were only two new crimes committed.
Wow.
In the 3 years that we were operating. Mm-hmm. We built lives.
Yeah. Do you, like, talking about addiction and addiction to cocaine, addiction to many, things, addiction to fame, power, people have all sorts of addictions. What do you think Buddhism has to say on how to deal with addiction?
How to deal with addiction?
Yeah.
I really can't give you a good answer for that, because the one weakness that I had when I was working in these venues was what to do with addicts.
Yeah.
My approach with the Incarcerated Veterans Program was to hire military vets who are alcoholics.
Yeah.
You know, they're on the 12-step program. Yeah. But those guys were instrumental in the operation, because I don't know beans about addiction, because I don't have any addictions.
Yeah.
They knew everything about addiction.
Yeah.
And they were both really instrumental in the success of the program.
Helpful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you also say that, like, the military training taught you a lot, as well as your Buddhist training. So I think at one point in your book you say the Marines teach self-sacrifice and monks teach and live the secret of life, which is to enjoy self-sacrifice.
Yeah.
That's a nice – that's come from a personal experience, right, from you?
Yes.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit more about that idea?
The Marine Corps, which I was a part of for – 2 years, teaches an ethos that I think goes beyond what some of the other military branches. I mean, there's a real mystique about the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
People go, whoa, Marine. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that ethos is the fact that they're almost like Greek Spartan soldiers, in the sense that the person's life on either side of you is far more important than yours.
Yes.
You know, you're not dealing with the political stuff and the ideology and stuff. You're there to keep the two guys on either side of you alive.
Mm-hmm.
And they're there to keep you alive. Mm-hmm. And the Marine Corps takes that very seriously, to the point of actually risking people's lives to retrieve dead Marines. Never leave a man behind.
Yes.
There's a great sense of camaraderie. So when I went to Sri Lanka, I began to study Buddhism. I found close similarities in ethos, I guess you could
say. Putting others first.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
To the point of sacrificing your own life.
Wow.
And I know many Buddhist veterans and active duty service people. And, you know, one of the things I think of in that regard is, why should we prohibit or prevent people who function in a violent capacity from Dharma?
Mm.
You know, are they bad guys because they kill bad guys? Well,
they need it more than anyone, right?
Yeah, well,
people are suffering with anger and these type of things. Is that what you're talking about? Or?
No, it's we've had two righteous wars in our past, in the past 100 years. One was World War II. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it was very necessary. Mm-hmm. And the other was the initial 2002 invasion of Afghanistan when we fought the Taliban to bring, you know, sense of decorum back to that country. Oh, where was I going with that?
Well, this might be an interesting segue into recent events. So, you know, the tragedy in Paris, over 100 people were killed, and so how do you respond to that, and how, you know, being a Buddhist teacher and helping people with Buddhist a Buddhist approach to their lives, when people ask you, well, how should I think about these things, what should I do, well, how do you counsel them?
It's a really tough one.
Yeah.
Because obviously most of my Buddhist friends around the world say that violence is not the answer to this problem. Mm-hmm. And it's an enormously complex issue. But you know, the bottom line for me is that people, innocent men, women, children, are being slaughtered.
Yeah.
Women and girls are being rounded up and turned into sex slaves. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, this will not do. Mm-hmm. This shall not pass. Mm-hmm. What else are we going to do? I've been asking that question on Facebook, okay? Yeah. All of my peace-loving friends, how do you deal with this? Mm-hmm. And the only nonviolent answer that came up was my suggestion that we all meet on July 4th in Tel Aviv, 100,000 of us, and march into Syria and talk to these people as a stupid idea.
Your approach is to, like, to go to Pakistan, to go to Syria.
Sure, why not?
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, that kind of killing has got to stop.
Yeah.
And I don't know, the only way I know for it to stop is to engage them militarily. Mm-hmm. So that makes me a real unpopular guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, and most of my other Buddhist veteran friends, they're really kind of keeping low on the issue.
Yeah.
They really don't know what to think. People who are really firm in some of their convictions and maybe a little shy on human experience can see things in a more kind of a black and white way, but come on.
So you feel quite alone in that perspective amongst your Buddhist veteran friends, or is there?
I think they all believe sort of in the same direction that I do, but they don't
want to say it.
Yeah, and I'm out there on Facebook,
saying, let's
just, you know, what's the matter with you people? Yeah, it's got to stop.
But if you reflect honestly, you feel that something has to be done. Tough stuff.
So it is. It's a moral dilemma for Buddhists who love life and don't want to see these people hurt. These people are beyond the pale. They're as bad as the Nazis were and the Imperial Japanese.
Yeah.
And we knew what it took to stop them.
Yeah.
So I don't know anything else. I'm just a dumb Marine.
I don't think so. But, you know, here's the thing, right? If we talk, we're Buddhists and talk about Buddhism. And then, so Buddhism is supposed to resolve the problem of suffering, right?
Yeah.
And so, and often Buddhist tools are used internally rather than in external capacity. So, like, we can talk about, you know, maybe we'll talk about this. Are there times when you have had huge struggles in your life when you've turned to Buddhist tools to help you get through them? And what have those struggles been like, and how has Buddhism helped?
Gosh, the last time I was upset is when my budget ran low in 2006, I think. I literally have a very happy, the most, I can't think of a time, you know, when I'm in a bad mood. Mm-hmm. I love what I'm doing. I love being out there. Mm-hmm. I love everything. There's a concept. I brought this up with Andy once, and it's a Native American word. Ojibwe and Cree, and the word is Ogichida. Mm-hmm. And what Ogichida normally translates into mm-hmm. for people who aren't aware of the subtleties of Native American language is Ogichida mm-hmm. means warrior, mm-hmm. but it doesn't. It means protector. Mm-hmm. And there's many Buddhist veterans who, when they walk out the door, their mindfulness extends to what's going on around me. What potential is there for somebody to get hurt? One of my friends, Frank, in Chicago, he watched a murder happen right outside of his front door. Mm. But we see it as a Buddhist duty to be the guys, because we are trained to do so, to run toward the sound of mayhem mm-hmm. and to do what can be done to stop the mayhem. Mm-hmm. That's what Ogichida mm-hmm. means. You protect others, even if they're total strangers.
Yeah.
These are men who would literally take a bullet mm-hmm. for somebody.
And a stranger.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Do you, the Buddhist ideal of the Bodhisattva, does that resonate with you? It sounds like it might.
My Mahayana friends call me a Bodhisattva.
A Bodhisattva, yeah.
But I tell them, I don't believe in Bodhisattvas.
You don't believe in Bodhisattvas? So, why is that?
Just trying to be humble, I guess. I've never paid a bill in my life.
Yeah.
My wife has made all the money. Mm-hmm. And I get to go and be altruistic. This mm-hmm. is the system that we've worked out. Yeah. I stayed home when the kids were little. Mm. But it's a wonderful life. You can't imagine how wonderful it is. Mm-hmm. Every time I walk into the ghetto, every time I see those little kids at 3 o'clock on Sundays, all the little things that I'm involved with bring joy mm-hmm. to my life. I was a good social worker because I didn't see it as stressful. I saw it as challenging. I would rub my hands together whenever a juicy crisis fell in my lap.
Yeah.
And I was just good with them. Mm-hmm. There's something I learned back when I took instruction in the Episcopal Church mm-hmm. for lack of, I was really curious about Christianity and wanted to see.
When was this? How old were you?
This was, it was in the... the 1990s, mm-hmm. I guess, the late 1990s. Mm-hmm. And I learned something there that really struck a chord, and that there is three ways to approach religion. Mm-hmm. One is through piety and morality. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Southern Baptists don't have anything on the piousness and morality of the average Sri Lankan jungle villager, mm-hmm. you know. You don't even see girls and women on the street at night mm. because that's just kind of the way they are. And it's piety, morality, and it's Buddhist-based. The second is through scholarship, mm. through study and reading mm. and learning and discussing and debating. And the third is through good works. Mm. One of them isn't superior to any of the other two. Mm-hmm. It's all different expressions of people's spirituality. Mm-hmm. But I've always been kind of a good works guy.
Yeah.
And it's just because I enjoy it so much. I my thing right now is I sit with dying World War II veterans. Mm-hmm. They like to have a veteran come by, and we do veterans recognition ceremonies. And, I'll visit them for weeks or months until...
What are these people asking you? What are you talking about at this time?
The
with the veterans, and as they're like, you sit with a lot of veterans who are about to die and stuff like that. You mm-hmm. do a lot of that sort of work, right?
I do.
And so what are the conversations you're having at that point? What
with the men that I'm serving?
Yeah.
You'd be surprised that it can be relatively light.
Yeah.
It's not that veterans don't talk about their experiences.
Yeah.
They just don't do it until they're 80.
Yeah.
I'm seeing that with my dad. Mm-hmm. Never said five words till he turned 80. Now I can't shut him up. And he was through some pretty nasty, hairy stuff.
What do you think that's in the military? Why do you think that's the case? Is there like a just a code, or is it just like a thing where there's a time and place for that, and that time and place is it happens to be towards the end of your life? Is that something like that?
When veterans are among veterans,
yeah,
they'll talk about their experiences, okay, but it's from a perspective of if you haven't experienced it, there's no way in the world you're going to understand it.
Yeah, they need people who can relate.
Yeah, and you know, people ask stupid questions, and you know, it's just easier to just kind of be quiet about your military mm-hmm. path. Mm. But they do kind of get talkative when they get a little up in years, because I guess they're thinking, if I don't share this now, I'm never going to be able to share it.
Yeah.
So I get to hear some pretty cool stories.
Wow. And do these experiences that the veterans have had change their approach to death?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah. So when you're talking to a veteran about death and dying, and the Buddhist take on it, is it different to when you're talking to a someone who's not a veteran and in the same situation, but they're not a veteran? Is it a different discussion, or is this type of thing we all face and we have the similar fears and
yeah?
And so how what's your experience been like helping people in those times and spaces?
Military veterans tend to not fear death.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't occur to them. Mm-hmm. To be fearful of death. And I don't know if that's similar to the way a Buddhist mentality would develop over mm-hmm. time as you meditate on those topics mm-hmm. and appreciate more and more the reality of what life and death are. They know that.
Yeah.
They've been there. Yeah. And they're lucky to be alive, many yes. of them. Mm-hmm. So we can be pretty straightforward about it. We even kid about it sometimes. Yeah. I've got a patient who lives out of town, about an hour away from where I live, and I go to visit him mainly because he's the most irascible human being you'd ever want to meet. Nobody gets along with him. He's a terrible man.
You say that with affection.
I do, because I love this man. I'll probably see him before the end of the week is out. He has actually read Buddhism for Dudes.
Oh, great. What do you think?
And he says that it has definitely changed his way of thinking about stuff.
Yeah.
When I first picked him up as a patient, he had just lost his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So he's just a miserable human being to begin with. Plus he's dying. Plus he just lost his wife.
Yeah.
And like I was saying before, if you just shut up and let people talk,
yeah,
you want to ask questions and just mainly to let the other person know that you're really interested in what they're saying. But, and I've been using this trick for years as a social worker, if you allow somebody to say what's on their mind and deal with their issues from a verbal perspective, just the fact that they have to organize their thoughts enough to express them is a big help.
Help, yeah. And so, just being attentive is a powerful way to communicate with someone.
Mm-hmm. Now, some of these guys I don't get until they're in a coma and within 48 hours of dying, but that's called 11th hour in a hospice mm-hmm. work, where this little team of folks who literally do sit and hold people's hands until they pass away.
Wow. So you're doing that work as well?
Yes. Wow. Yeah.
Continue. And it could be people you've never met before.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Oh, I love meeting new people.
Yeah. I'm sure that's like a learning experience for yourself as well. It's not just a benefit and comfort for the person.
Oh, certainly.
What are you learning from those experiences?
Mm-hmm. I'm a writer. I collect stories.
Yeah.
And I don't know sometimes how they play in to stuff. But, you know, just I had a patient once who was in Europe, in the European theater during World War II, and he was in a T-11 tank, mm-hmm. not a Sherman tank, mm-hmm. but a T-11. They were small tanks with double Cadillac motors in them. Mm-hmm. And they were tiny and really, really fast. They could go 45, 50 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. So he was telling me about how 8 or 10 of these tank crews would have to swarm around a German panzer tank to take it out. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Yeah. I had a guy once who was, he was a tail gunner on a B-24 and got shot up. Fascinating, just fascinating. Everybody's got, I don't know, I think everybody's fascinating.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in what people have to think.
Mm. People's stories, fascinating yeah. stuff. Especially yeah. these guys, these adventures and tragedies.
And they, wow. you know, they kind of come up again. It's kind of like the story of Angulimala.
Yeah.
There's so many different ways to look at that story.
Yeah. Why don't you tell the story? Because people, the listeners
Angulimala?
Might not. Yeah, that he's collecting the the fingers.
Angulimala was a real badass during the time of the Buddha, and he was a notorious serial killer. It's my understanding from his history that he was really an intelligent man who got mm-hmm. soured on life. And whenever he killed and robbed someone, he was kind of a highwayman, he would cut off one of their fingers and add it to his necklace of fingers that he had around his neck, which made him, I guess, all the more fierce. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at the mythology of Angulimala, when he encounters the Buddha, Angulimala is just ravenously wanting to kill the Buddha, and he runs toward him, and the Buddha is just kind of walking along, but Angulimala cannot catch up with him.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of tend to think that they just had a really, really interesting conversation, and Angulimala, this notorious bad guy, mm-hmm. Became an arhat. He became a follower of the Buddha and eventually achieved enlightenment. Mm. But.
Here's the but.
Here's the but. And it says a whole lot about human nature. Mm. He became a monk. He became a good person. He was out begging his food like all the other monks. But the people that were aware of his history did not cozy up to him.
Yeah.
He had that reputation. And it's difficult to make a leap of faith mm. when you know somebody has been so terrible and is now a much better person. How are you going to trust that that person? That's one level that you can look at the Angulimala story.
Do you work with prisoners at all?
I have. I don't from a Buddhist context.
Yeah.
We're making overtures right now. Our new temple, my friend Bhante Nanda and I just opened it about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And we're making all kinds of new connections in the community.
Yeah.
And there's a number of prisons around Louisville. And I know that the monk intends to do that. I've had my fill of prisons, to be honest with you. I worked in them for 3 years.
Yeah.
And like I said, we did some cool stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, imagine, here's Angulimala, and then I look at my own career when I was working with guys coming out of prison. Some of my clients were sex offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And I did an editorial on this once, actually. How do you... No, I take that back. It was for a... the thing on NPR that Ed Morrow started
was
back
it interview
in the
50s. Or a piece of writing?
It was a piece of writing.
Okay.
It was, God, what do they call it? This I Believe.
Oh, This I Believe.
I wrote a This I Believe, and I was talking about being a Buddhist and having to deal with sex offenders mm-hmm. as a part of my job.
Mm-hmm.
And I said I was just as fond of these people as I was any other former inmate that I work with. They're people.
Mm.
And if you can relate to them on an even level, the point I made was that, you know, a lot of people are going to be upset about the kinds of things that these people do.
Mm-hmm.
in the community, but it didn't help anybody if I felt that way.
Yeah.
I had to be neutral, and I found it pretty easy to be neutral. Mm-hmm. Once you start learning some of the facts about sexual offenses, you find out that 95% of them never reoffend.
Mm-hmm.
They never reoffend. And the 5% who do, those are the guys, and you can tease them out with psychological tests. Those mm-hmm. are the predators.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the ones you want to keep away from society.
Mm-hmm.
These other guys are so eager to make up for what they've done.
Yeah.
But again, what I was saying was, if I care, if I'm emotionally invested mm-hmm. in their goodness or their badness and make judgment calls,
mm-hmm.
Based on what they did, that's not going to help anybody.
So your point is that to help them, you had to maintain some type of equanimity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I really didn't find that hard to do. I mean, I've known many murderers in my day, and they're some of my most favorite people in the world.
So let's go back to Paris then.
Paris.
Yeah. Can you have the same approach to that problem?
To
help the situation while maintaining equanimity. How do we do this? Because there's an implied suggestion that there won't be another offense, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're helping the people you're talking about,
right?
Part of the qualification was it's implied there won't be another offense. So you are able to help them, and to do so you have to maintain equanimity, right? And if you get wrapped up in the story and the past, how can you help that person?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And maybe there's a lesson here for how to approach bigger scale problems such as Paris. I'm not suggesting a solution, but that's another approach, right? We have to mm-hmm. approach these larger scale problems in the same way.
We still have 99,996 slots to fill in the big 4th of July march to mm-hmm. Syria.
Yeah. Oh, yes. So people can sign up.
Let's sit down and talk.
Let's sit up and down and talk with equanimity, right?
But, you know, when you're talking about the kind of ideologies that drive people to mm-hmm. behave that way.
Mm-hmm. But as soon as you say that, you're getting wrapped up without equanimity, right?
Yeah.
I'm pushing a little bit here.
Well, what I'm thinking is, when you look at the behavior of Japan and Germany after World War II,
mm-hmm.
they turned, and of course we helped them a whole lot,
mm-hmm.
and immediately mm-hmm. To help them rebuild their countries and their economies. That's obviously, I don't know what's obvious and what's not.
Yeah.
Because Nazi ideology is something that is very foreign and not understandable, and why do people do that sort of thing?
Yes.
And the Imperial Japanese the same way.
Mm-hmm.
But what if militarily the world could get the upper hand? And I'm not saying that that's possible, because the neighboring states won't do anything
mm-hmm.
to help even take Syrian refugees.
Mm-hmm. Tough questions. Tough questions.
Very.
And maybe like a light approach. Like, I know we're talking serious stuff here because of recent events. But really, you know, and I appreciate your approach in your book, which is very lighthearted, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you, even though you talk about some tough stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you say things like, it takes guts to be a Buddhist dude.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about hiding in your own little world. It's about living and meeting all of life's challenges in a meaningful an unselfish way.
Mm-hmm.
It's about superhero ethics.
Yeah.
I love that. It's so inspiring, right? And I think this is the beauty of your book. Like, you know, Buddhism for Dudes. It really speaks to that inner dude. So, and I was wondering who you imagine reading this book.
Oh, gosh.
Like, who do you imagine when you think about your readers?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they're diverse. And who have you given the book to, and who said, I loved your book?
The target audience for the book is mm-hmm. not an easy target audience mm-hmm. to crack, because mm-hmm. they'd much rather watch the NFL on the weekends than crack a book. And that's just, you know, most of them may not have even read a book since high school or college. They're just not readers. Most of the offerings out there can be maddeningly obtuse, difficult to understand, contain an agenda. There's lots of different, there's so much out there. I wanted to give people something, a good, decent place, objective place to start.
Yeah. So you don't need any prior background in Buddhism to pick up this book?
No, I don't think so.
No.
I've tried to render it as understandable as I could, using sort of guy analogies very frequently. Women, I get feedback from women all the time on it. Not a single one has said that they thought that it was sexist.
No,
or anything like that. They love Buddhism for dudes.
I think it's a great gift for the for their men in their lives, right?
I want to push that. Yeah,
and they should have a little sneak read of it because there's some great little nuggets in here, and you know, and it's true. I think that anyone can pick this book up and almost start anywhere in it and get something of value out of it.
I like humor. I think humor is a huge. Anything can be improved with humor.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess you could see things that way. Buddhism for Dudes is, I tell people that I wrote it for the guys I used to play golf with.
Yeah.
And they were all construction workers and, you know, although they were fairly well read. But really what I had in mind, in the back of my mind all the time, is our military guys. I got, before you guys published Buddhism for Dudes, it was a self-published ebook for a while, and then Andy got a hold of it and just made it a wonderful thing. I got an email once from a top sergeant in Iraq. Wow. At the time, saying that, thank you for Buddhism for Dudes. It helped keep me centered during my last Iraq deployment.
So he was in Iraq and he had this book.
He had the book.
And was reading it and it was helping him.
Yeah, just an ebook version of it.
Yeah.
2 weeks after the book came out, I got an email from a woman in Norway who said that she'd been depressed and didn't leave her bed for 6 months until she read Buddhism for Dudes. And then she called it the book that brought my happiness back.
Oh, wow.
And that, God, that just killed me.
That's got to be massively rewarding for you.
Yeah.
I heard that on the way out here, you gave the book to someone in uniform. Was that
yes.
Right?
This morning, on my flight from Louisville to New York, there was a lieutenant colonel. Yeah. From one of the toughest outfits in the Army, the 1st Cavalry Division. Mm-hmm. They're the vertical envelopment guys. They're the helicopter people.
Yeah.
They trade in their horses for
helicopters.
And he appreciated it. He said that he was really going to look forward
to reading it.
And, you never know.
Great.
You never know. You give a book to somebody, they like it. They pass it on to somebody else. Pretty soon I got a call. Hey, would you like to teach a class at our church for a couple of sessions? We'll pay you $40.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it's just kind of snowballing, I guess. But I get comments from all over the world.
Fantastic.
About the book and lots of military guys.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about, so having worked with you at Wisdom, I know you have quite a... your schedule, your writing schedule, and you have certain hours where you're creative. And I wanted to ask you about, if you could share a little bit about your schedule and as a writer, what's your process?
Well, you got to factor in a little bit of health as well.
Yeah.
Because I have fibromyalgia, which means I need more sleep than usual, which is paradoxical because I rarely get any decent sleep at all. But around 10:30, my wife goes to work at the hospital. If she's not there already working a 12-hour mm-hmm. shift. My dog is asleep. The noisy birds in the backyard are quiet. And it's just, there's no traffic noise. I don't hear sirens. It's the time. I guess I just sort of train myself that 11 o'clock at night to 3 in the morning is creative time. Yeah. I do stuff all day long, marketing myself and editing, reviewing, thinking up new ideas and stuff. But that's when the words actually come down.
From 11 to 3 a.m.
Yeah.
You're riding away.
And I'm funny at that
time. Yeah.
And then I'm never funnier than midnight.
And then then at 3 a.m. you go to bed?
Sometimes 3, sometimes 4.
Yeah, wow.
About an hour before I figure I'm going to go to sleep, because, again, I have fibromyalgia. I take Neurontin, and that puts me to sleep pretty well. So I can really kind of time it based on when I take my Neurontin, but those, you know, I just can't get to sleep before 3 in the morning. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. You know, anything can be turned into an advantage.
Yeah. And so, like, service and writing has become your Buddhist practice in a way, right?
I think so.
Yeah, nice.
I learned from several of my gurus in Sri Lanka that the most blessed thing a Buddhist can do is to share the Dharma.
Share the Dharma,
And that's, I've been doing that since I started practicing, you know, 13 years ago. And I've typically had one-on-one students. Mm-hmm. I was taught one-on-one with these, you know, eminent people who found the time for me. So that's normally the way I've done it. Yep. But I tinkered around with that book for a long time.
Nice.
I'm a magazine writer. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't do stuff over 1,000 words. And, you know, as my career, you know, it was a mildly profitable hobby for 40 years. This Buddhism for Dudes is my first book.
Well, I ask you not to stop writing books, because this is a special book.
And, thank you so much.
And so then, you know, that was wonderful, and thank you for sharing the Dharma with us today on the Wisdom Podcast.
Thanks. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Next week, we're fortunate to be joined once again by our good friend Bhikkhu Bodhi. And in this episode, Bhikkhu Bodhi tells us about the Buddha's daily routine. He also talks about the different Pali words for meditation and what the Buddha meant by mindfulness.
The way I've tried to express this to myself is to say that sati, I call it a bending back of the stream of awareness back upon oneself, upon one's own immediate concrete experience, physical and mental experience, in order to bring clarity to that experience. And so I would say that sati is what keeps the object present before one's attention. Or even we could maybe render sati as attentiveness.